Ready, Carl?
Yes.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the December 18th meeting of the Portland City Council. Would you please call the roll?
Novick?
Fritz.
Dramatic.
Fritz.
Here.
Fish?
Here.
Saltzman?
Here.
Hales?
Here. Okay, we're going to be resuming. Oh, go ahead and read the item, please.
Item 1332, consider proposal of Mark Edland for demolition review approval and the Bureau of Development Services staff recommendation for denial for the demolition of the Buck Prager Building, a contributing resource in the Alphabet Historic District, built in 1918 to allow for the construction of a six-story apartment building with below-grade parking on the west half of the block at 1727 Northwest Hoyt Street, LU14210073DM.
Okay, so we'll have a number of procedural checks here as we get started. First, it's been a week since the previous public hearing, and I think a number of us have had discussions about this, so it's time for us to disclose any ex parte contacts or potential conflicts of interest that weren't mentioned at the last hearing.
I'll start, Mayor. My staff has fielded some phone calls and had some conversations with people that they have not shared with me. And I have run into an alarmingly high number of people over the last week who actually have been in this room at one time or another. And I have on each and every occasion said that the only thing I could not talk about was the substance of this proceeding. And so I scrupulously avoided doing so and talked about everything else.
Okay. Dan? I have one ex parte contact to mention, not with someone who's been a party to the case, but I revisited the site and had a brief discussion with a former member of the Design Commission, Lauren Waxman, who's not a party to this case as someone who has testified about it or who has a financial interest in it, but he did have some expertise on the subject, and I asked him some questions about it. So I was, again, trying to deepen my understanding of the design issues involved and consulted a former member of the Design Commission. Also met at some length with the staff to go back through their recommendations and the basis for those.
Could you summarize what you heard from Lauren Waxman?
I asked Mr. Waxman what he thought of the prospects of this building for renovation. Anything else? So does anyone have any questions or concerns about these ex parte contacts? And again, no one has disclosed any potential conflict of interest. Okay. Catherine, I think you have some procedural guidance for us before we resume the hearing.
At this point, no. I think where we are is just, I think there are two remaining people to hear testimony from.
And then
close,
rebuttal.
Close the hearing and then rebuttal and then close the public testimony portion.
Correct.
And then the council, I guess we need to know at that point from the applicant whether they intend to waive the final 7 days for written legal argument that state law affords them.
Okay. We can ask them that when they come up for rebuttal.
Yes.
Right. Okay. All right. Thanks. And then let's return to the sign-up sheet for those folks that did not get to testify at the last hearing.
Those two are Seth Johnson and Rick Michelson.
Okay, come on up. Looks like only Rick is here, so. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor Hales and council members. I'm here to talk about why I oppose Rick Michelson, here to testify about the proposed demolition. The applicant's argument seems to come down to 4 points. One, the comp plan calls for more housing in the area. Two, the site can accommodate more housing with the existing height and FAR limits. Three, the existing building makes it difficult to achieve that full FAR. And therefore, because it makes it difficult, the building should be torn down. I think this is a case that is emblematic, what could be emblematic of the proposals in many of our historic districts. And I want to run through how it would work in Skidmore Old Town. The comp plan calls for more employment opportunities. More employment opportunities require more office space. Many of the buildings in Skidmore Old Town are built to less than the maximum FAR and less than the maximum height, and has serious seismic issues with them. In order to fully maximize those sites for meeting the comp plan goal of office space and jobs, those buildings need to be torn down and destroyed. I don't think that's adequate for tearing down a historic resource, and I think it would set a very bad example throughout the area. I also think that this proposal is not fully gelled yet. They've talked, and it doesn't give you enough information to make a decision in favor of demolition at this time. They talked about two proposed public benefits. One is shared parking with the neighbors, which is not allowed under the zoning code, and therefore they can't provide it at this time. And the other is affordable housing, which they will only be able to do if the city and others give them public subsidy. Giving public subsidy to get a public benefit at the expense of a historic building, I don't think is a good choice necessarily. Finally, in terms of mitigation, if you're going to have an impact on the historic district, you need to do something to mitigate the effects. I sent you a memo about different possibilities. The only mitigation that they've proposed in their application is to name the building for Johnny Pesky, who's an important neighborhood figure and historic, but has absolutely nothing to do with this site. And therefore, that's not really mitigation for this particular site. I think one of the issues that's pushing this is that the developers are presuming and have presumed from the beginning that they can get maximum FAR and height on the site, even though it's been in a historic district. They've been advised a number of times by a number of people that they should go to the Landmarks Commission first, do a design advisory review to talk about what's appropriate on site and not before coming to you. To tear down a historic resource, I think you really need a compelling story with adequate findings, adequate background. You don't have it here. I've passed out the findings and conclusions you made in the Dirty Duck case to demonstrate what I would find compelling. Those were compelling reasons for approving the demolition. No reasons of that sort are being presented to you today. Finally, I don't really know why we're here today. You know, they can't get the demo permit until after the building permit is issued many months from now and after it's gone through design review. So what's the point of pushing this? I think today you have two choices. One is to deny the application because you don't have any basis and findings to support it. And the second would be to set a set of conditions on it that might make it acceptable, but you don't have any information to do that today. Therefore, I would recommend that you deny the application at this time. They can always reapply once they have a real proposal. Thank you.
Thank you. So others may have questions for you as well, but obviously you've been around these issues of historic preservation quite a bit, and so it's appreciate you coming to testify. Let me pose to you the same question that I asked Mr. Waxman standing out in front of the building, which is that if you owned this building and the city were to, in effect, say to you, you must keep it, go figure it out, what would you do with this building and what would you do with the other three parcels that you own there, the two parking lots and the non-contributing old apartment buildings, some small apartment building? What would you do with this property if the city said you got to keep the building?
I would do a series of things. I would do within the existing building, similar to what we did at 19th and between Kearney and Lovejoy, where we took the old film studio building and divided it up into small working spaces. I would do that within the building, provide an adequate courtyard space for light and air on the side of both sides of the building. On the 10,000 square foot site to the north, I would propose an apartment building, probably not a full FAR of 4-to-1 or full 65 foot height, but something more like the Dirty Duck is at four stories in the same side of zoning. On the south side, I'm not sure whether I would keep the parking or I would build some additional working spaces on that would be compatible with the neighborhood. I think there are a lot of opportunities. The problem that the developers are having is that they're presuming the land cost is way above what is appropriate in the district. And my friend John Russell says the only flexibility in any of these projects is what you paid for the land. And if you pay too much for the land, you've made a mistake and can't justify tearing down a building because you paid too much for the land.
Another question I had after revisiting the site is a block to the west is a seven-story building. I think it was built by Pat Prendergast. Not sure if I got the builder right, but anyway, it's directly facing Cooch Park, occupies half the block. The other half of the block is occupied by well-maintained older, some historic, no doubt, buildings. Why is that interface okay there and out of scale here?
Well, let me add a little bit more to that. There are also two additional buildings on 19th Avenue North near Johnson Street that were also built to six-story and closer to full FAR than is appropriate on this site. All of those received approval from both the Landmarks Commission and with the support of the Neighborhood Association. I think the difference is this site that we're looking at is bordered on both sides by our most historic blocks of houses that are a much smaller scale, and there's not the relief of the park that allows a taller building to be there. If you look at Cooch Park, you can see that there's a ring on the west side and now, on the south and now on the east of taller buildings that help frame the park. Because of the park, they don't overwhelm and dominate the street frontage the way this building would next to these houses. So you've got to look at each site specifically in order to see what's compatible.
Thank you. Other questions?
Thank you, Mayor. I have two questions. The first is, in your opinion, why did the applicant not come forward on the alternate approval criteria about economic value?
Well, as the applicant said to you and testified, the building's ready to occupy today. All they have to do is turn on the lights and rent it. So it's not, there is economic use and economic value to it. It just would not perhaps get the rent level that they feel appropriate.
Okay, and the second question is, we heard arguments on both sides about the precedential value of a decision here. And I want to give you a chance just to offer your opinion on that subject.
Yeah, I think there people use the word precedent differently. In a legal sense, one land use case is a precedent for another land use case from a legal point of view. But I think the tone in the decisions that the council makes and the Design Commission and the Landmarks Commission makes on each case steer the next application towards what is the community finds acceptable and what is not. As I was talking about in Old Town, if this building can be torn down, I think it's a lot easier to tear other buildings down and do something similar in other portions of the city. So, on the opposite side of precedent, and I'll use the word not legally, I think you folks set an incredibly good precedent on the Dirty Dock. If you read through what was found there, what was necessary to approve that demolition and replacement, I think that's exactly the precedent we should be following.
Could you remind us the nature of contributing structures in a district? And this building isn't drop-dead gorgeous in itself, or it would have been listed as a landmark. Why is this particular building of more value than some of the hundreds of other contributing structures or the non-contributing structures?
Well, I think it has more value than the non-contributing structures because it is more similar in scale, more typical of the type of building built in Northwest. The three-story buildings with an entrance at the center of the front are fairly typical of not just this kind of commercial building, but office building or apartment buildings that line many of our streets. So in terms of scale, it's typical of the background of the neighborhood. What's odd about this one is that there isn't anything next to it, so you see the side, but that could be remedied. One of the things you've got to remember about the national doing this through a district is that you don't do as much individual research on each building as you would if you were doing an individual nomination because they all fit together as a whole. They're all teeth in your mouth. Not each one of them has to be great. They just all have to work and work together.
And is it all about the buildings or is it partly about the historic uses of the buildings?
There are a number of criteria for getting approval on the National Register or in a district, one of which is the quality of the architect. One is the, and I'm not going to get this quite right, the style of the building and how quality it is. And the other is a place that it places in the history of the community. For instance, we're dealing with the Bernard Goldsmith House on 24th and Quimby now and going through that process. Our primary strength on that one is because it was owned by the first Jewish mayor in the city of Portland. So that's going to be at least 50% of the justification for our application on that.
Thank you.
I guess one last question. If we rejected the application and maintained, and essentially the status quo was maintained, is there an irony that we would be, in essence, locking in a surface parking lot that is hardly compatible with either goal 7 or 12?
I don't think denying this application is going to mean that that lot at site is locked in forever. They're going to look to do something different on it, either restore and reopen the existing building or do infill or come back to you with better justification for the demolition with better mitigation and better public benefit. It's not going to just sit there.
Other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Okay, so that's going to close the public testimony. And, oh no, folks, sorry. Please no. But I don't think they showed up. Did the other person arrive? Okay. So read that name again, please.
Seth Johnson.
Johnson. Okay. So I'm going to close the public hearing then and then invite the applicant to come back up for rebuttal.
Mayor Hales, just to be clear, you're closing the public testimony.
Public testimony. Sorry, not the hearing. I get those words right. Words matter. Thank you. Welcome.
Mayor Hales and Council, for your record, Tim Ramos. With me is Mr. Tess from Heritage and Jill Sherman from Girding Eadlin. We've submitted our rebuttal in writing for you and won't go into detail except on issues you have questions. We have members of the team here to talk about those issues if you have questions. We'd like to focus our time on the issue of mitigation, and in particular the council's discussion about affordable housing and the question about where the need is the deepest in the city. That's an issue that during the discussion had resonance for Mark O'Donnell and I as owners. Our family histories in this neighborhood, of course, started with predecessors who were searching for the least expensive place to find an apartment on a bus line. And for both of us, we've focused our pro bono work over the years in our firm on the issue of affordable housing, in particular housing for people of low income who have developmental disabilities. So we like the idea of connecting the project to that issue. And I'll ask Jill to speak to that.
For the record, Jill Sherman, I'm a partner at Girding Eadlin, and Mark Eadlin was not able to be here today. I'm going to talk about two things. One is the issue of feasibility of redeveloping this building. We did, as we mentioned previously, do a significant amount of work to look into the options to redevelop this building, both as an office building as well as a residential building, and determine that is just not feasible. In other words, the cost to renovate will not get you the rent that you would need to have an economically feasible project, primarily for some of the things that we've previously talked about having to do with floor-to-floor heights, the existing character of the interior of the building, and the need to do full seismic and other systems upgrades for that building. The next thing I want to talk about gets to this idea around mitigation, and would like to describe the current, what we think of as the current mitigation aspects of our project, and then talk about perhaps some proposed conditions that could provide additional mitigation. The preliminary concept plan included what we would consider a significant budget for design features to mitigate concerns, and these were concerns that we heard in our very early and initial meetings with primarily some of the immediate neighbors to the site, and have to do with below-grade parking, which we've discussed. We're including it. We're not required to include parking. It's below-grade, which is desirable but expensive, and we're providing an adequate number of spaces to serve the number of units we're proposing. We're also proposing to continue shared use, recognizing that the property owners have been successful in figuring out a way to do that in the past, and that we would propose to work with the city to make that possible to do in the future. We did try very hard to articulate and mask the building in a way to be sensitive to the houses on Hoyt and Irving by making it four stories at that location, only up to six stories toward the center of the site. And that was based on kind of shadow studies and sightline studies that we did to compare it to other options that showed that it was, in fact, less impactful on the neighborhood. We incorporated very high-quality materials that would be compatible in terms of their permanence as other historic structures in the neighborhood. And we committed to apply for the city's multi-program, which, as you know, would commit 20% of the units to be affordable to households earning at or below 80% of median income, which would, in fact, provide a resource in that neighborhood that doesn't currently exist in abundance. In other words, a lot of the new units are not serving households that earn at or below 80%. Today, we're proposing to address housing affordability beyond just our project and in a way that gets to the folks who we've heard from the commissioners, you know, and know from our own experience are the most in need in our community. We're proposing to devote $45,000 a year for 10 years to sponsor the low-income housing, senior housing work of the Northwest Pilot Program. We did get a letter from the director, Susan Emmons, and understand that she'll be able to use that sponsorship to provide housing and eviction prevention services to 100 low-income seniors per year. So over 10 years, you'd be serving about 1,000 people. We would suggest this requirement be added as a condition that we would implement through a development agreement that we would work with city attorney put together, and again felt that this was a way with a contribution from the project to get significant bang for the buck in terms of assisting those who have the highest need. We also heard a lot about the proposed height massing and FAR associated with our proposed very preliminary concept. To address that, we're proposing a condition that the building we construct be reduced in height from the 75 feet allowed by the zoning to 59 feet, and the FAR would not be reduced. The shift in using our mitigation budget for the affordable housing and in changing the building would impact our building design, but we're confident that working with Holst Architects, we can still deliver a quality project that we'll all be proud of and that will enhance the community. So while the design may change, we would still include provisions for the shared use parking, for adequate structured parking, and we would still submit for inclusion in the multi-program. Thank you.
Questions?
I'm just curious how you came up with $45,000 a year.
Well, we did some initial looking into what the difference was between the 80% units and if we went for more affordability. And frankly, we quickly realized that that difference would basically render the project not economically feasible. It's about $250,000 a year to take the 16 units from 80% and put them at 60%. So while we recognized that was not something that we could do, we still wanted to do something that would have a significant impact on low-income members of the community. And based on relationships that Mark O'Donnell has with Northwest Pilot Project and understanding, having a discussion with them about what they could do with a certain amount of annual resources, came up and it's something that we thought could work for us and be meaningful.
Mark spoke to the executive director and asked what sort of contribution would be meaningful and would make a difference for you, and the response was we could help 100 people a year with $45,000, and that's where it came from.
So following up on that, remind me, under the revised proposal, how many apartments would you contemplate?
We haven't designed it, so I don't know, but we're proposing the FAR would not be reduced. So it's 4-to-1 FAR, but that nowhere on the building would be 59 feet in height.
Just a range of what so assuming you had a mix of sizes you were thinking about and what you could design, what are the goalposts on what you might be able to get in terms of number of units?
I would say 75 to 80 units.
One of the concerns that I have, and by the way, I think I compliment you for the creativity of the Northwest Pilot Project proposal, because it's a target population in our city that is facing unique challenges. One of the concerns that I have, Jill, is that we have a significant shortage of available units for the populations that are being priced out. And one of the great advantages of this particular area of our city is that it's a high opportunity area. It has access to amenities. And so adding units in a high opportunity area, for me, is more preferable than having a fund which subsidizes people who may not be able to find housing. And we have such a shortage of units because of the dynamics that if we don't actually add units, which is the virtue of the tax abatement program, it gives you an incentive to add them, what we're doing is still rolling the dice that someone can find a unit in a very tight market. So for me, dedicated units in a building are worth more than a fund to provide relief for people who ultimately may not be able to actually find housing. So the challenge, I guess, we have with the tax abatement program that you've referred to is it's a competitive program judged against all the other applications with a statutory cap, so you may or may not get it. And if you don't get it, it seems to me there's a significant drop in public benefit in this project, and I'm not quite sure how to reconcile that. Thank you.
So I know you're not quite sure how many units, but the mix, again, proposed mix of studio, one-bedroom, two-bedroom, three-bedrooms, do you?
Well, in the original concept, we had actually about 40% studios, 40% one-bedrooms, and 20% to 25%, perhaps a little fewer studios, two-bedrooms. We believe it's a great opportunity for small families in that location, great schools, great location, et cetera.
How many actual units of two bedrooms would that be?
Well, when we had 82 units under that scenario, we had about 18 two-bedrooms.
So let me return to a couple of issues if I can, and others may want to go back to this discussion as well. But so when I asked Mr. Waxman the same question I asked Mr. Michelson, you know, what would you do with this property if you owned it and the city said you got to keep it, he frankly didn't come up with much and mentioned the seismic issue that you mentioned. But when I met with staff, I learned something that I hadn't quite understood, and that is that I believe you have to spend about $40 a square foot in renovation costs before you trigger the full seismic review. So it is possible, if I understood them correctly, Ms. Adam and Mr. Heron, that you can do a substantial renovation, not remodeling, but renovation of a historic building like this that's unreinforced masonry without triggering the full seismic retrofit, if I got that right. So are there not scenarios by which you renovate this building and stay under that $40 per square foot ceiling and not, therefore, have to try to absorb the extraordinary costs of a full seismic retrofit?
I mean, under any scenario that we looked at in terms of what we thought you had to do to upgrade the systems and the interior and the exterior of the building, you would exceed $40 per square foot. You would be leaving the building in you know, fairly similar condition with perhaps some cosmetic changes, and I think the owners tried to lease it as is for a number of years.
I'll add also that because our intention is to be in ownership for a long time, the idea of leaving an unreinforced masonry building without seismic upgrade is an unattractive proposition.
Okay. Hear you. Mr. Michelson mentioned the design DIR process. Why did you not go through that process in advance of this proposal, given that obviously you've got to go back to the Landmarks staff and the Landmarks Commission to get design approval for a building here? I know it costs more to do the design in advance, but given that you're going to have to do that anyway and that you have a pretty high bar to clear here in order to demolish a contributing building, I'm a little puzzled as to why you didn't go through that process, particularly after staff encouraged you to.
Yeah, we considered it. We talked a lot to staff about it. There's sort of a chicken or egg question about where you start. We figured sooner or later we're going to be in a design conversation. We had some pretty clear messages from the staff about where they were going to be at on it, and they said they were reflecting what the design commission would probably say anyway. So we decided let's get on with the fundamental question, and we know that the design issue is one we've got to take on.
Have you, Jill, have you, assuming council denies the application, have you considered what are the options for what you could do with the parking area in terms of building something that's compatible or complementary to the existing structure?
Any alternative that we have looked at, which we have looked at many, we found both a problematic because it still assumes you can renovate the existing building and leave it, which we don't think is feasible. And two, we thought was a less attractive and beneficial solution to cohesively redeveloping the half block and being able to provide below grade parking, which you won't be able to do if you leave the building where it is.
Right, you can't do eighth block underground parking.
And even quarter block is very expensive and inefficient.
I just want to go back for a second to the question about how many of the units might be two-bedroom. It's actually one of the most attractive features of the proposal, as I heard it last week, was that you thought that this would be family housing. I mean, given that you're scaling it back, is there any kind of commitment that you can make that a certain fraction of the units will be suitable for families?
Yeah. Yes.
And what do you think that realistically could be?
I knew you'd ask that. I mean, I think that it's reasonable that even if we scale it back and let's say we lose 2 to 7 units is what we've ballparked, that we would maintain the same number of units that we have today as two bedrooms, which I believe is about 18. So we would end up with a slightly higher proportion of two-bedroom units in a fewer unit building.
There's no possibility of having any three-bedroom units, is there?
Three bedrooms are very, very challenging. We could certainly look at it and see if it's feasible to do a couple as part of the project if the owners are amenable.
Yes, if that's an important consideration, we'd address that.
I'll state here for the record that partly in view of conversations we've had about other demolition issues recently, I'm looking for places that for families with some means to live other than McMansions. So I'm looking to you for a place for alternatives to McMansions.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Follow-up items for the applicant here. And then do we need to check in with you about the 1 week period for additional written testimony?
Yeah, we would be happy to waive that additional opportunity. Okay. We think we appreciate very much the amount of time that the community and the staff and the council has spent on this up to now. I would say also that these are our ideas for mitigation. If the council wishes to engage further in that conversation, we're happy to do it.
Okay. Well, just to follow on Commissioner Novick's question and answer with Jill about 18 two-bedroom units, that's regardless of whether you get any tax subsidy from the City of Portland for the
correct
affordable?
Correct.
By the way, again, if we denied the application, is there anything that prevents you from refiling at some point after you've determined whether you qualify for the multifamily tax exemption? Excuse me, not the multifamily,
yeah, that's right.
The multi?
The multi.
I guess, you know, we started working with the owners on this project and this piece of property almost 2 years ago and it's taken a lot of sort of time, thought, meetings with both the neighbors to determine what we thought was the best route, and we have not taken that lightly. So I think our, you know, preference would be to move forward, apply for the program. We think we can put together a very compelling application, the two-bedroom units in particular, the location and what an opportunity area it is, et cetera. We think that, you know, we would have a good chance of being successful.
You know, it's one of the things that's challenging for me, Ms. Sherman, is that, you know, the staff has come in very heavy on the goals and the policies are not met and the balancing test, very heavy. And, in fact, it's one of the strongest recommendations that's come to us on a land use matter I've been involved with. And I was involved in the Dirty Duck discussion and agree with Mr. Michelson that there was a compelling public benefit. Also thought that the building was about to fall down at the time as well. But there was a compelling public benefit, and we also got a really beautiful building out of it. And for me, it's a little challenging where, you know, the balancing test where recommendations to us from staff and reviewing the record puts the balancing test, you know, from at least from your point of view, at risk. And I don't have a compelling public benefit to point to throw into the mix. And I appreciate the effort you've made today with Northwest Pilot Project, which is a superb addition to this project. But I'm personally concerned that they're just, I have not personally seen enough public benefit here in a case where the balance also seems to be at risk. And so I don't know in the ordinary course what's the best way to sort that out, whether it's to give you the opportunity to come back at some point with another plan or to engage in an interactive process with this council. This is a somewhat unique proceeding, so I'm not sure what's the appropriate way to go forward.
But we're happy to accommodate whatever process you want to use to address that or other issues. We're not here to argue any particular procedural requirement. We're here to engage in a conversation about how to get a great building, how to make a good decision, how to make a good contribution to the community, and how to stay involved as families. So if the result of the council's discussion is that the majority of the council feels the balance weighs in favor one or the other and you want to reach a final decision, we understand that. If you want to continue the proceeding in some way, we're open to developing some way to do that in consultation with you and the city attorney.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now I have questions for staff.
Okay. And could we bring Mr. Adam and Mr. Heron up?
So Commissioner Fish just teed up the question I was about to ask, which is in terms of balancing the comprehensive plan goals and objectives and your analysis. And can you talk to us about the issue here is demolition of a contributing structure, and how does any public benefits weigh into, how does that get weighed into the findings on the comprehensive plan findings?
Hillary Adam, PDS. I think that the public benefit would be weighed as looking at the comprehensive plan goals and policies in the Northwest District goals and policies. I didn't see much related to those goals and policies in their proposal that I could point to say that they were doing that in exchange for proposing demolition of a contributing resource. And the approval criteria says that you can look at the merits of the demolition or the merits of the proposed development, the merits of preserving the historic resource, and the effects either or would have on the area's desired character. And again, I didn't find that it was on balance met by the proposal to demolish.
And tell us again about your understanding of a contributing structure in a historic district.
There are different levels of significance as they pertain to the National Register. There's a National Historic Landmark, which something like Independence Hall in Philadelphia would be. Then there are historic landmarks in our city, which are generally buildings that are individually listed in the National Register, and that is based on their merits by themselves alone. There are also historic districts that are listed in the National Register, and those consist of contributing resources and non-contributing resources. Sometimes landmarks are also included in there because they are already there. Contributing resources are those that specifically contribute to the significance of the historic district. Non-contributing buildings are those that don't. They may have been built later. They may have been significantly altered to the point where they're no longer recognizable as what they once were. The Alphabet Historic District was listed in part because it was associated with significant events, meaning the development of that neighborhood, significant people that are associated with that neighborhood, and then also significant architecture. So this building was listed as contributing, I think, because of when it was built, the style that it was built in, and that, I believe, was specifically why.
And the Irvington Conservation Community Association mm-hmm. talked about their district and expressed concern that allowing removal of contributing right. structures would impact them. Do you agree with that assessment?
That gets into the precedent argument. I believe their letter was talking about how historic districts are stronger because of the collection of buildings that are listed as contributing, but not specifically individually listed or landmarked on their own. So it's the strength of all the buildings together that makes it special.
And I'm just reviewing the Landmarks Commission letter again. Has anything that you've heard in testimony, does it make you think that if the Landmarks Commission, well, first of all, did the Landmarks Commission hear most of the testimony that we heard?
Yeah, they were here for almost all of the hearing last time.
No, I mean, when it was before the Landmarks Commission, was anything new raised before us that was not raised for them?
I don't think so.
So they essentially weighed what we heard and came down in favor of denial.
There were no testifiers in support of demolition at the Landmarks hearing. I'll say that.
And the Landmarks Commission says that they would likely find a large 4 to 6 story development would not be an appropriate neighbor to the 14 landmark houses.
Mm-hmm.
I know you're not the Landmarks Commission, but does the offer to take it down to 59 feet, is that a significant difference?
I mean, 59 feet, that's still a 4.5 story building. At the hearing, one of the Landmarks commissioners specifically said that she didn't see herself approving something more than 3 stories. There seemed to be general agreement with that. Obviously, it's open for discussion, and it depends on the actual design that's presented to them.
And the burden of proof is on the applicant, correct?
Right.
So we would have to find some compelling reason to overturn to disagree with the Landmarks Commission's recommendation.
Right.
Tim, were you involved in the Dirty Duck case as staff? I can't remember.
All day. Yes, I was here for that. Tim Herron, BDS.
Okay.
We call it the Kiernan Building.
Yes, sorry. It's just that with the alliteration makes it memorable. Nothing else memorable about it. Thoughts about this case and that case as critical indicators of how we weigh this contributing building issue?
I think Tim Herron, BDS, the applicant said, I did everything I could to convince them that coming in for a design advice request or a historic advice request with the Landmarks Commission, as it were, would be helpful. And what I heard in testimony at the last hearing and today was the one missing piece we're not talking about is the potential replacement should council find the resource to be demolishable. That's unfortunate because I think that could have been part of the conversation about what kind of volumes, what kind of massing, what kind of articulation in the building form that could replace the resource the Landmarks Commission could have weighed in on. We haven't had that conversation. That could have helped this Type 4 proceeding. It's one of the things to consider in the approval criteria, meaning the merits of the replacement of the resource. And as we heard from Landmarks Commission expressing some concern about the proposal of the step down 6-story to 4-story. I'm also concerned not just with thinking about height, but thinking about the full block, full half block frontage of 200 feet along 18th as being an issue. Any of the buildings that approved more recently by the Landmarks Commission were either on a quarter block at 5 stories, or if they were taller, Mr. Mayor, as you mentioned, the Park 19 or the park across from Cooch Park has a significant recessed alcove that goes from ground to sky in the middle of that half block development. So I'm just concerned. There's lots of architectural moves that can be made. The firm they've retained is clearly one of the best in the city. But what we're talking about is basic fundamental massing and height across a 200-foot frontage between two sets of very important landmarks. Properties that are much lower scale.
I'm inclined to agree with you that it would be nice to have a design and advice request at the front end on this, but I want to flip that on its side or flip that on the other side for a moment and be a little bit of a devil's advocate. The code criterion that we're looking at for trying to make this decision, 2B says the merits of development that could replace the demolished resource either as specifically proposed for the site or as allowed under the existing zoning. And then D, the effect that redevelopment on the site would have on the area's desired character. how would it be possible for an applicant in a situation like this to meet those criteria without reaching a fairly high level of design and perhaps getting a DIR at the front end? I mean, in other words, is it even possible that you could meet those criteria if we don't know details about the design?
I think it's definitely possible. I think that's where the advisory request meeting would have been helpful to have had walking into this type 4 review, so we would have had some fundamental components. The type 3, if the demo review is approved by council, a type 3 landmarks commission hearing is required. What is very protective about the type 4, and I had mentioned this to others, is this is the only second review we've had of a type 4. The process works by virtue of no one's really taking advantage of it since 2004. This is the second one. In part to looking at some of those details, I think that's where I get back to if we could get to a fundamental massing. When we did the Blanchet House, it was a quarter block and a quarter block only. This is a resource of 1/8 block and scale with 3/8 remaining to be redeveloped or redevelopable, meaning if the resource was retained, there's more block left to redevelop. The Blanchet House was a quarter block for quarter block. During the DAR, we talked about design and details, kind of designing a fabric building. We did it with some subtle renderings with details to follow with the formal process. It was also proposed at 3 stories during the DAR process as it informed the Type 4 when they came back after council found the demolition was approvable on merits of public benefit in that case. Ultimately, a 4-story building was approved. And the Landmarks Commission at the time felt like the additional story that was added since the original DAR for the Type 4 was fine, but a lot of that was based on the merits of the detailing that building provided as a part of that required Type 3 process.
And so, there was also a significant public benefit. The fourth floor was housing that was added.
Right.
To
it wasn't like a different kind of use. It was just an expansion of the same public benefit.
Other questions?
So in your opinion, if the Landmarks Commission had been presented with a proposal that had affordable housing in it, do you think that would have changed their decision?
I don't think it would have changed their perspective on what was appropriate for the neighboring historic landmarks. I think just going back to the optional DAR, if they had had that in the beginning, then maybe they would have had a better idea of what landmarks would have been open to in terms of mass and scale, and maybe could have resolved their program around within that envelope. And it would have made for a more compelling argument for me and maybe a perhaps more balanced staff report.
Thank you.
Question about sort of the relative contribution merits of buildings. My understanding, whether it's your 478 contributing structures in this district, something like that?
I don't remember the numbers exactly. I think there are 400 and something resources.
Right, sorry, contributing resources. So do some resources contribute more than others? I mean, could you like rank them 1 to 478? And if you could, where do you think this one would fall?
They are not ranked that way. There's either contributing or there's non-contributing. As I said, there are some that are landmarks, which, you know, are even more special, that they deserve listing on the National Register on their own merits. But in terms of looking at the district as a whole, it's only contributing and non-contributing. This one, I think, at the time of listing of the Alphabet Historic District, not enough research had been done with regard to its specific history. It is possible with that additional knowledge that we now have, perhaps it could be listed on its own merits.
So does that mean that we are bound to treat each resource as contributing as any other resource? There's no way to make, you know, look at gradations of contribution?
You're human, so it's not really, in the code it's not specified that way. The code only talks about contributing and non-contributing. Granted, some resources have been modified a bit and don't look like they once did, such as this one. Others are in extraordinary shape, like the Trankman homes just to the south. Again, the approval criteria talks about considering the merits of preserving the building versus the merits of demolishing it and the merits of what's proposed in its place.
So, I mean, some of the opponents of demolition have said that if you allow this to be demolished, then all contributing resources have to be allowed to be demolished. Do you think that's really true?
I don't think that's what they meant. I think what they mean is that they're all at risk now because we will have learned, if demolition is approved, that historic preservation isn't necessarily as lofty a goal as we thought it was, or that you can propose redevelopment or demolition of a historic resource to be replaced by a primarily market rate apartment building.
Okay, any other questions for staff? Oh, Mr. Heron, go ahead.
If I may, a couple of final points that I didn't hear addressed that were raised at the last hearing. One, the zoning for the site was in place before the historic district was created. However, we feel that the potential to redevelop the site and still meet minimum zoning requirements as desired by those goals of the RH zone could still be met and still retain the resource.
What's your basis for that belief?
Just minimum density requirements for the RH zone could be met if the remainder of the site is developed.
Minimum density?
At least minimum, not maximum.
Not necessarily maximum.
Right. I think the maximum may be problematic depending on size of the units, obviously. More three bedrooms is more volume. More studios is less volume. But the issue is compatibility in context of this new addition to the historic district. And I think that's where there's going to be pressure on height. There may be pressure on overall FAR bulk, if you will, of the proposal.
Make your second point, but I want to come back
sure.
to that.
And then the second point, Commissioner Fish, you expressed some concern about the Landmarks Commission reviewing new development and suggesting perhaps the Design Commission to review the proposal legislatively. That's problematic. I also don't think that it's necessary. The Landmarks Commission is made up of several volunteers across the spectrum of development. You're correct that their focus is preservation and restoration. But we have been and are reviewing new full block developments. One, in fact, by Gertie Neeland Development is a three-quarter block on a vacant site next to the Ocon building in the Old Town Skidmore district. So they're warming up to new construction, so that's not a concern.
And I didn't mean to imply they didn't have the capacity or the expertise to do it. I was just struck by the vehemence of their position against the proposal.
Thanks.
And how does that same body then perform that other function against a strong conviction that there should not be a demolition to begin with? And it just,
I Fair
was
enough.
Struggling with that, not so much whether they had the tools to do their job appropriately.
I think the commission, the Landmarks Commission, was put in a position of not having anything to react to. The entire conversation was on demolition, not a potential replacement. And when we did the Blanchet House and did a DAR, that was a challenge because even doing a DAR for new development presumed council would approve the demolition.
So your point earlier about, you know, looking backwards, sort of Monday morning quarterback saying maybe if there had been had they sought voluntary design advice, it might have had some impact. The code currently says that's optional.
Correct.
Is it optional because it's an undue burden?
No, I think it's just a newer process. For me, what I've found on Design Commission's role, which is extraordinarily busier than the Landmarks Commission, especially of late, we're seeing all of our Type 3 projects taking a voluntary design advice request to get some predictability in what the final, a formal proposal, what the envelope is, what the details, what are the expectations.
Well, and it just seems to me, I mean, whether it's optional or mandatory, where we're asked to balance things like the compatibility within a historic district and the how it impacts the district and looking on either side of the street to imagine, you know, the size and scale and its impact, it seems to me, as you said, it it meant the Landmarks Commission didn't have as much to react to, and it puts us in the position of dealing with a lot of imponderables, a lot of things that are not before us, and I'm not sure that is our best role.
I don't disagree with you.
So let me pose a dilemma here. One of the things that's been difficult for me to weigh in this case is the entitlement that the RH zoning confers on the property owner and the conflicting entitlement that the historic designation, in effect, confers on the community around it. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of property owners who own property in historic districts. Is there, in your opinion, an entitlement to an envelope building, that is, a building that achieves the full density?
Not necessarily. The historic overlay is as much an overlay as the zoning code overlay. I think some other example, one of the reasons why Irvington became a historic district was because they wanted to preserve some of the fabric and the scale and the compatibility. One of the reasons why the Buckman Neighborhood Association wanted to pursue historic district nomination is because of the different zoning code envelopes that were otherwise entitled to by the zoning code were not protected or able to be preserved. That process failed because a number of people spoke up in concern of the regulations around historic districts. And a lot of that has to do is compatibility and consideration of adjacent structures and adjacent sites. Large buildings in the Alphabet Historic District have been approved recently and exist there in the past. But we do look at each site on a case-by-case basis, and this particular site presents a challenge given the adjacency of the much smaller scale historic listed landmarks on the north and south of this site.
Okay, and we discussed this before, but go back there for me if you would, and that is to a block away where we did entitle an envelope building or something that's very nearly close mm-hmm. to the theoretical envelope there across Gooch Park.
Mm-hmm.
I asked Mr. Michelson that question. He said it's because of the situation of that building, but yet it has two-story buildings immediately adjacent to it.
That was a big concern. I also did that review. That was a great concern in that the approach to that building from the east going into the district, it would be very visible. One of the struggles that the Landmarks Commission had when reviewing that project was how to detail the end walls of that project. And what they ended up deciding was because it would be so visible, they detailed it actually much like the front facades. It has a lot of detailing, as opposed to being a more typical end wall with lack of ornamentation that you might see in a historic district. That building also has another front, a more formal front, and that is Cooch Park, which is on the uphill side of the building. So the sense of that building having more gravitas, if you will, as well as height, was found to be appropriate, specifically because of its relation to Cooch Park. That project also received a transfer of FAR from a historic landmark, so it was actually billed above the entitled FAR for that site, but because of a provision in the code that allows you to transfer landmark FAR, it went up in height. And I think in consideration of that, the Landmarks Commission, while they struggled with the upper story of that project, it did ultimately receive support from the neighborhood and then obviously from the Landmarks Commission.
I assume there's been some turnover on the Landmarks Commission since then, but mm-hmm. is it largely the same commission?
I think it's half are there. There will be some institutional memory. I'll provide some institutional memory.
Clearly. Thank you.
But there are new commissioners.
All right. Thank you.
Just to further go into Mayor Hales's question about the balance between what's allowed under the RH zone and what's required under the historic preservation requirements, there's something in the record, and I'm desperately trying to find it, about a previous decision that Art DeMuro was involved in, where we have previously established a precedent that, in fact, the historic resources, the area plan, it trumps the base zoning. Can you remind me of what I'm referencing?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Commissioner. In the course of talking about big buildings in historic district, which is relatively recent, meaning bigger new buildings, that very case, the one off of Cooch Park, was one of them where we had some back and forth, and we did have confirmation from the city attorney that the guidelines do mean something, that the zoning entitlement is not necessarily a right in a historic district. The guidelines, that layer, that historic layer of approval criteria, can shape mass, require additional detail, and perhaps require wood windows, for instance, if as appropriate, are part of the entitlement.